This is the, what you might call the apex appointed bit of the week. This is the great television democracy show, and Steve is going to guide us through a rather erudite piece of history to do with democracy. So I'll hand over.
Okay, do you mind if I sit down? Okay, I'm going to try to use television to illustrate something about democracy this evening. I'm going to start off by telling you a short story. A Communist Party official goes into a Chinese school classroom, and he looks at the very well-dressed little boy sitting in the front row, and he says to him, "Boy, where are we living?" And the boy says, "We are living in a people's democracy." He says, "Very good." And he says, "Boy, who is your father?" He says, "My father is the great communist fatherland of China." "Very good." He says, "Boy, who is your mother?" He says, "My mother is the great communist party leadership of China." "Excellent. You will go far. Tell me, boy, what would you like to do when you leave school?" "Become an orphan." And in a sense, what democracy is about is removing yourself from a position where you are constantly sucking upon the teat of leaders, where you are endlessly looking for some sort of authoritarian figure who is going to work things out for you, write the script for you, say the lines for you. Democracy is about confidence, it's about self-reliance, it's about speaking as well as simply spectating, it's about listening, it's about cooperating. It's actually a deeply active process. Democracy is something that takes energy and doesn't probably lend itself to simply becoming a spectacle on television. In the beginning, so to speak, there was the written word, long before the lunatic's lantern of television. People read books. Books were the main circulating channel of ideas in society. Sometimes the force of the law, that embodiment of capitalist justice, was needed in order to ban books, destroy books, throw their authors into prison, tell the printers that they couldn't produce the books because they were illegal. In July 1792, Thomas Muir, a Scottish printer and Democrat, was arrested for encouraging the distribution of Tom Paine's famous pamphlet, The Rights of Man. The Rights of Man had that year been declared to be an outlawed publication. It was a seditious libel, and to read that book was to commit a crime. Lord Braxfield, the chief judge in Scotland at the time, when he sentenced Muir to 14 years transportation away from his family, and Muir was only in his early 30s, said the following: "A government in every country should be just like a corporation, and in this country it is made up of the landed interests, who alone have the right to be represented." Lord Braxfield, the chief judge in Scotland, was also the president of an organisation called the Society for Preserving Liberty and Property Against Republicans and Democrats. Well, that tells you which side the law is on. The following year, Arthur Young wrote a book, highly reactionary, miserable, and anti-democratic, and therefore extremely legal and non-subversive, called The Example of France, A Warning to England, in which he said, and I quote, "Give the vote to the poor, and it follows, by direct consequence, that all the property of society is at the mercy of those who possess nothing. And could theory have blundered so stupidly as to suppose for a moment that attack and plunder would not follow power in such hands? So it's pretty clear that both Lord Braxfield and Arthur Young, the author of those words, were very much aware that there was a direct threat from passing political power, or the chance of political power, to the majority of people, and the sanctity and security of property. Between then and now, much has changed, and we can argue historically, perhaps we should argue historically, about why much has changed. There was, after all, in this country, the Chartist movement, there was a movement for trade union rights, people were thrown into prison, people gave their lives for those movements. And I suspect that the reason they were so heavily resisted by the capitalist class is because democracy and working class organisation was seen as a threat to property. But much has changed between the end of the 18th century and the end of the 20th century. We do now have a position where there is a belief that democracy has got something to do with capitalism, that we are living in a democratic society. But something else has happened technologically. The printed word has given way to the television screen as the main medium for disseminating ideas in society. In the 1959 general election, 75% of Britain said they got their main election news from newspapers. By 1964, only 5 years later, this is how fast things can change, 80% of people said they got their main political news from television. Democracy has ceased to be a dirty word, and it's turned into one of those apple pie symbols of all that is good. We are all Democrats now, to coin a phrase. And of course, NATO sees to that. We all have the vote, and we thereby become voters, political consumers, the gullible victims of the spin doctors and their froth of imagery and sound bites. We inhabit what is spuriously described as the democratic world. We inhabit it, of course, as lodgers, not as landlords. Democracy has become a part of the vocabulary of triumphant capitalism. But it's become a part of the vocabulary that is misused frequently. As Ralph Miliband wrote in his book Capitalist Democracy in Britain, which was actually quite a good book, published in 1982, I quote, "Earlier generations had feared democracy. Their successors now proclaimed that it had arrived. Whether the people wanted power or not, they now had it. The point was to keep that power in safe hands while proclaiming that it had passed into the hands of the people. If democracy had arrived, there was no need to agitate for it. The politicians' appropriation of democracy did not signify their conversion to it. It was rather an attempt to exorcise its effects. In reality, the idea of democracy had made little progress with responsible people. They were reconciled to more and more members of the working class having the vote, but they thought it absurd and intolerable that ignorant multitudes, quite likely to be swayed by unprincipled and self-seeking demagogues, should have real power in the making of policy. A carefully limited and suitably controlled measure of democracy was acceptable, and even from some aspects, desirable. But anything beyond that was not." And I think Miliband has the measure of it there. Yes, the rhetoric of democracy was adopted, but it had to be very carefully controlled. In the decade after the majority of workers won the vote. We saw the rise of television, not just in Britain, but in other countries. In 1923, the British Broadcasting Company, as it then was formed under the management of John Reith, a fanatical religious moralist. And during that period, what we saw in the 1920s, a decade after all, after women had the vote in Britain and therefore a majority of workers had the vote, was this movement to control democratic discussion, to take it out of the streets, away from people who might misuse it, to take it away from the tongues of the orators on the street corners who are engaging in real discussions with real people, and to pack it, to suck it and absorb it into this thing here, where you have a studio and where you have control. Now, the BBC was, it remains, an extremely centralised, tightly controlled organisation. It was rewarded for its tight control and its opposition to the general strike in 1926, when it played a major role, this is BBC Radio, in opposing and breaking the strike by being given the right to become a corporation with a licence fee paid by the people who own television sets. And incidentally, I was at a seminar the other day in which somebody came up with an extraordinary statistic, which is that the BBC in 1999 has more people working on chasing and collecting its license fee around the country than all of the people who work for MI5. So it's actually a very active organisation. Its data matching on its computers is actually more sophisticated than any other organisation in Britain. The BBC promised to do certain things. One, it promised, and it still remains in its charter, and it's well worth remembering this, that it would put on to the BBC, radio or television, any message that the government instructed it to, and without having to make an announcement that the government had instructed it to do so. Secondly, it agreed at the outset in 1927 that it would not cover any matters of political controversy. It introduced what was called the 14-day rule, which meant that for 2 weeks of any controversial issue being discussed in Parliament, the BBC wouldn't discuss this. That remained BBC policy up until 1958. Thirdly, it agreed that it wouldn't cover election campaigns. The BBC had a policy that elections couldn't be covered because you mustn't allow anybody but the politicians to talk to people. And if you try to cover it in any sense, you might be accused of bias by the next government. So the BBC started out, it's changed somewhat of course since then, with this extraordinarily hesitant and timid approach to reporting anything. I'm going to show you, and in the remaining minutes I'm going to show you a few things that I think are actually historically quite interesting. An archive now of the election of 1935. This is a BBC coverage of the 1935 election. And what they did in 1935 was they simply announced that the election was happening, didn't cover the election campaign for the following 3 weeks, covered nothing in the radio news, including any mention of the election. So they would cover, you know, the goings on in Abyssinia or work in the League of Nations or anything at all about the latest, crop in New Zealand. But they wouldn't cover the election until the day that the election result was produced, was given, and then they would cover it. This is quite rare footage, actually, of the coverage in 1935. No sound.
To put the news on the air. Here's more election results.
Kingston on 10.
Father stayed up to learn if the country was going to be saved or was going on as usual.
Elected.
Robert paused before the conveniently open window and heard that the government was doing nicely.
939.
Sailors at Chatham ignored lights out to listen in.
Conservative.
Theoretically, the Navy has no politics. But Jack has a strong bias for whatever party puts a bigger navy prominently in its program. This humble citizen coaxed a cat's whisker and listened in without neglecting to mind his hole in the road, a triumph of citizenship over circumstances.
Do you see how, I mean, obviously we all see that it's terribly stuffy and patronising, but it's actually what Miliband was describing. It's the triumphalist celebration of democracy in an utterly undemocratic and condescending fashion. That's the great ability, the quality, the confidence that British broadcasters have been able to show in talking as if there is democracy, but at the same time subverting it and undermining it by their description of it. Before World War II, there existed a culture of authentic democratic discussion, not just in Britain, but in many countries. That culture of discussion was to a very great extent a hangover from the movement to win the franchise in the first place. Street corner meetings in parks in every town in the country, villages having meetings, if not every night, then every couple of weeks, in their market squares. And this is terrifically important. People went to them, they argued with people, they took away literature, they learned. This was a living democratic culture. And aspects of it, of course, survive in Britain today. We know about them. If you go to Italy and you look at the piazza gatherings that happen there, in parts of Greece, in parts of the world where there are political crises going on, some of those still have this aspect of living culture. But to a very great extent, it is now a memory. And perhaps it's a memory we need to ponder, because it is very important for us to recognise that there was this real moment, and can be this real moment, of spontaneous democracy, of let's all talk about it, let the person doing the talking stop talking if someone has a question or a point or wants to take the platform or wants to raise an objection or wants to correct a fact, all of which is what democracy is about, not just talking, not just listening. Again, fairly rare archival footage, there's lots of this incidentally, so I'm just going to show you a little piece of it, of Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park before the war. There isn't a picture amongst that group of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. There is, in fact, amongst the archives that I've got, some quite interesting 1930s recording of the Socialist Party. And it was there, and it was part of the culture. And in fact, if you look at films in the 1930s, people went to meetings. And the concept of a public meeting, there were books published on how to organise a public meeting. And people had a sense of the rules of those meetings. And democracy isn't actually something you can't, there are two things you can't do to practice democracy. You can't practice it.
Sorry.
It's all right. It's okay. Stop it. There are two things you can't do about democracy. I mean, one is you can't sit at home and practice it as you would, you know, all kinds of other things, because it's not a one-person activity. And secondly, you cannot see it reflected by looking into the screen of a television. It is inevitably a social activity. It is an activity that has to be dug deep into the culture and the living environment that one's a part of. And it's either there or it isn't. And if it isn't there, then it's extremely difficult to experience and to train and to mature as a democrat. Then came what was called the war for democracy. It wasn't a war for democracy. It was a war for empire. It was a war for territory. It was a war for economic interests like all other wars, but it wasn't a war for democracy. Significantly, by 1939, the only way you could sell a war to the working class was as a people's war. It's about us. It's about the ordinariness and daily lives of people. And a vision of the working class was created. And I contend, I submit to you, that this image of the working class became terrifically important, because we still see it in the soap operas of today. In Britain, we see it in the British films of today. We see it in the way that the tabloid press speaks to us today. It was an image of the working class created in the early 1940s, at the request, and indeed upon the instruction of the Ministry of Information, which was a propaganda ministry that existed in order to promote the war effort, largely contrived by Oxbridge graduates who had a very condescending idea towards the working class, who made very good films, particularly documentary films, about working class people, which was on the one hand extraordinarily condescending, which looked down on workers, which worked on the assumption that workers were these sort of happy chumps who would go off to work every day with a smile on their face, listening to these atrocious tunes by George Formby and Gracie Fields, these you know, really the you know, the some of the worst products of 20th century culture. And on the other hand, it was an attempt to speak triumphantly, to celebrate the working class. You know, you the workers, you're the ones doing it, you're making the tanks, good on you. And of course it was sort of throwing pennies on the working class. It was rubbing shit in the faces of the working class. And there were scores of these films made during the 1940s. And I think it's actually very interesting to watch them. We can only watch a very small part of any of them here. Let's just take a quick look at one of them. This is a film that was made called Listen to Britain, probably one of the most popular of the ones made during the Second World War. And I think you'll get a feeling for, I mean, look at this and you start to see the editorial writers of The Sun and The Mirror with their fake northern accents, and you start to see the soap opera writers with their phony working class community life actually getting their ideas. These were the images. And those are the people who Tony Blair thinks he's governing now, incidentally. So you should watch that very, very carefully. These are, so you don't need a focus group. These are, that is the profile created during the war of this, you know, somewhat idiotic, constantly dancing and open-mouthed working class, ready to do anything. Die for the country, my pleasure, mister. And that is the, and that is the image. The Ministry of Information contrasted this image of Britain, which was free and celebrated and tolerant, but above all, which was democratic, in which we're all in it together. That's the important point. We're all in it together. This image was contrasted with this fanatical, demonic fascism across the rest of Europe. That was the choice. But what I find interesting is that that fanatical, hateful view of fascism is the one that seems to characterize the media today much more than any other. That in a sense the Nazis lost the war, but they actually won the battle for the style of talking about war, of talking about politics, particularly the high international political conflicts. George Orwell in 1948 published his book 1984, in which he presented us with this horrific society in which everything we were told about was to come from one source, all coming through one television screen. And of course, it was compulsory to have that television screen in your home. You dare not switch it off. Of course, it's worse for us now. It's not compulsory. We actually have to pay the state to have this in our home. And if we don't pay the money, they come and arrest us. And so the imagery of 1984 was an imagery of this constant manipulation of emotions. That democracy is not about rationality. It's about who can manipulate emotions better. Hitler or Churchill, Stalin or Tito, Alistair Campbell or Milosevic's spin doctors. That was the image. And take a look at this. I mean, this is from the film 1984, and it was supposed to show just how horrific this totalitarian depiction of war was, how awful it would be to live under it. And then I can't help thinking, tell me if I'm wrong, because I have been, is that this is actually about Kosovo. This was the war we've just had. I was in that cinema. I was watching this. See if you were.
This is our land, a land of peace and of plenty, a land of harmony and hope. This is our land, Oceania. These
our people, the workers, the strivers, the builders. These are our people, the builders of our world, struggling, fighting, leading, dying, on the streets of our cities and on the front lines of our countries, fighting against the mutilation of our hopes and dreams.
You can't trust that Milosevic, can you? So this is it. And okay, it's not exactly the same. That wasn't Trevor MacDonald. This isn't you. What has happened is that the British news, the American news, CNN, BBC, they are more sophisticated. I mean, obviously, if they presented it to us quite like that, we would shudder for a while and then we would cringe and laugh, probably. But it is that kind of manipulation of emotions that I think characterises the way things are now. Television presents two great myths of democracy. One of them is that democracy is an event. You watch democracy. I have reason, because of my job, to go into Parliament every so often. And as I go in, there's something very interesting. Some of you will know this, others will not. There is always a queue of people, at least four times the number of people here, who are standing waiting to get into the place. And there's always a gaggle of people, probably about 20 or 30, standing by the members' entrance, watching the limousines go in and out, and crouching down as the limousines pass. A policeman pushed them out of the way as these cars come through. And they crouch down to see who's in them. And they say, oh, I think I recognise that one. Oh, is that Blair? Is it? And what they're actually doing is they are looking at this event called democracy. And then they queue up in this very long queue to go up into the strangers' gallery, because they are strangers to democracy, and they sit down and they watch it. And you have to actually sign a legal oath before you get in there, promising that you'll keep your mouth shut. Now, no one had to sign a legal oath before you came in here, promising that you will keep your mouth shut. But if you were asked to do so, I think you would draw a conclusion. And if you're asked to do that when Parliament is presented, on the one hand, as the mother of democracy, the home of democracy, this symbolic, living democracy, and on the other hand, you can't talk, you can't say anything, one watches it, that's actually a very subversive view of democracy. It turns democracy into its opposite, into a place where the majority shuts up. I just want to show you a couple of examples of this myth. You've all seen it, but let's just take a couple of examples of this myth.
In Parliament assembled, in the historic House of Lords, are Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, the members of the House of Lords, and assembling now, the members of the House of Commons, summoned from their own chamber to attend the Queen, and led in procession by the gentleman usher of a black rod, the Speaker of the House of Commons, and the Prime Minister and Leader of the Opposition. Thus, in Parliament assembled, are the three elements that constitute the formal Parliament of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, Crown, Lords, and Commons. A new session of Parliament may now begin, inaugurated by the Queen's speech.
My government will seek their full and constructive part.
Oh, I enjoy doing that. So there is, what do you see? You know, let us assume that a Martian were to come down, let us say from Mars, and look at that. Would that Martian conclude, oh, well, I can see straight away what's going on there. That's democracy working. Or would they say this is a pompous theatrical display? So democracy is something you watch. I just want to give another example of it, because one of the things that's most irritating about watching this democracy is that one thing they would always say to you is, aren't you lucky you can watch this democracy? Because you're living, this is where you are. You're in Britain, and this is a better democracy than anywhere else. Here's an example of it.
Doesn't it seem hard to be entitled to have a say? And that is part of living in a democracy. It's not, of course, something he would have were he living in Iraq. And I simply want to say to him I find it, to be honest, I think it's a sort of past anger, but I find it curious that he should attack President Clinton personally and mention not a word of condemnation of Saddam Hussein. It is a curious sense of priority that he has.
The second myth, the final myth, final point I want to touch on is democracy is presented as a partnership. Democracy is about all of us having an equal stake in something called the country, the state. We haven't. I don't need to, for a moment, spend any time reciting the statistics here, but the vast majority of people in Britain or in the USA or in the entire European Union, or in the entire world, if all of their wealth were added together, would not constitute as much as is owned by less than 10% of the people in those areas. Clearly, we're not all in it together. But don't they tell us we are? Let's take a look.
The protection of our freedoms, American labor, management, and capital, the greatest production team in the history of mankind, have made the United States the industrial master of the world. Capital must continue to provide industry with the funds to create new tools and plants. Labor and management must continue to increase the production of better goods at lower prices, so that more people will be able to buy the things that make life easier and happier for all of us. Then Joe will continue to be the king of the workers of the world.
So now you know. And you know, it's not presented as a comedy. You have to keep, pulling yourself away and say, when this is shown, people sit there silently, they look at it, they see it as something, not everyone does. Many people see that as a depiction of the democracy in which they are a part. They see it as something which is explaining to them, in very simplistic terms and accessible and believable terms, something about their partnership in a democracy. Fortunately, it becomes increasingly difficult to actually accept the accessibility and credibility of democracy. I don't know about you, but I find the more I actually watch some of the regular showings of democratic life on television, the more bewildering it becomes, the further away from it one feels. The House divides, the motion was put. Large numbers of people watch this sort of thing and don't know what they're talking about. Somebody was telling me how the other day they went into the House of Lords with a group of Iranians who had come over. And they said, who are those men sitting over there in the long frocks? And the person said, oh, they are the bishops. And the Iranians said, just like our country, you have them as well. So there is this sort of sense of it being bewildering. If you ever watch the business news on television, do you understand it? I mean, those of you who are Marxist political economists, I don't understand it. I find it increasingly bewildering, and increasingly, I suppose, it starts to fall apart and to fragment and to appear to almost parody itself. Well, here's an example of it actually being parodied.
It was a rather cowy night for the pound. It stood at 3.79 against the German bordello. That's up 0.5 against the Portuguese sterling and down 100 against the bitch. Earlier, there was confusion in the markets when France and Spain swapped their currencies and trading remained succulent for the rest of the day. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Here at home from...
Okay. What can we say about this mythology, about the way that television presents what it doesn't present, the silences that are conspicuous and need to be filled? What we can say is that in the corner of almost every home in this country and most of what are called the advanced countries, is a means of both subverting democracy and potentially a means of providing the information that people need in order to be more democratically knowledgeable and articulate. And what has happened is that there is a battle between forms of technology that is constantly going on. Within every form of technology, rather, there is this battle constantly going on. Television, when it first started, promised to be the great educator. It promised to open up access to people. It promised to provide a wider array of experiences to which people would be exposed. It promised to make the farmer more comprehensible to the city person, the person living in one part of the world more accessible to others. What it's done, it's created a CNN culture, a cultural monopoly. It's increasingly created a culture in which there is one voice, with one American accent speaking the script, in which there is one constant description of reality which you dare not oppose without becoming some sort of an eccentric or a dissenter or a utopian. And so it's a technology which is there to be used well, but which within capitalism, like democracy itself, becomes something that has the life drawn out of it and becomes increasingly a means of keeping people in their place, of putting the picture of reality imposed upon us rather than allowing us to make sense of the world. Final point. As socialists, we don't have the choice to ignore this medium. We can't simply look away, shut it away, close our eyes and refuse to look. On the contrary, what we should be doing is opening our eyes even wider and opening other people's eyes even wider, showing what kind of images they are receiving, what sort of selectivity they are exposed to, what sort of silences there are on particular issues and how they could be filled in new and radical ways. That is a role for us at the beginning of the 21st century, because without doing that, we are failing to oppose our greatest enemy as socialists and democracy's greatest enemy in the years to come.